This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Lately, a couple of states in America have been pushing laws to liberalize abortion. New York passed its law just 2 weeks ago. The left says they're just responding to a supposed effort to deny women their rights. But I want to expose what is really behind this push for more abortion. After that, we'll hear a report from Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the Trump administration suspending America's compliance with its nuclear nonproliferation treaty with Russia, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. Jeremiah is going to talk about why the U.S. really had no other choice, and yet how this development marks a re-escalation of the threat of nuclear war. We'll also have a conversation with Trumpet writer Josue Michels about a couple of European leaders who are taking a unique approach to addressing Europe's migrant crisis. They're personally taking up the cause of protecting Christians in the Middle East. This is a story with strong prophetic implications, and it highlights the coming clash between Catholic Europe and a radical Islamic force in the Middle East. And I'll conclude today's show by talking about your family's most important textbook. We're going to start, though, by talking about the expansion of abortion. 2 weeks ago, January 22nd, was the 46th anniversary of the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade, the 1973 case that legalized abortion. The New York State Senate used the occasion to pass the Reproductive Health Act. This law expands the state's already liberal abortion law, decriminalizing abortion right up to the birth. If a healthcare practitioner decides it's necessary for the well-being of the patient, including emotional, psychological, or familial factors, in other words, this represents abortion on demand right up to the birth. Now, this is how the New York Senate reacted as Governor Andrew Cuomo signed the law, as reported on a local news station.
The bill was first introduced in 2007 and removes abortion from the state criminal code and ensures women the right to an abortion in New York should that federal right ever be changed by the Supreme Court. But Cuomo thinks it should be taken a step further.
And do a constitutional amendment so no governor, no legislator, no political swing can ever jeopardize a woman's right to control her own body in this state.
They are really celebrating. They're really excited about how they're pushing back against all the outrageous efforts to deny women their rights. This is a crusade for rights, for freedom, for choice, for women, for equality. It's always spoken of in the most noble language. But what are they really celebrating? They're celebrating the expansion of abortion culture in America. Why now? Well, this is where we are after Brett Kavanaugh's confirmation of the Supreme Court last fall. That really shook the left. They don't want anything to jeopardize Roe v. Wade. That's why they did everything they possibly could to keep that man off the court. That's why they're taking aggressive action now, not just to preserve their current rights to abortion, but to expand them. Just last week, Virginia legislator Kathy Tran proposed a new state law, very similar to the one in New York, to lift restrictions on abortions during the third trimester, even up to the birth. And Tran was questioned in a subcommittee whether the bill would permit abortions during dilation, when the baby is starting to emerge. And she said yes. And she was also asked if she was aware of the long-term implications of how this bill was going to change the nation's attitudes toward abortion. She said, "Yes, I'm aware. I'm changing the standard." Similar efforts are also underway in Massachusetts, in New Mexico, in Rhode Island, in Washington. Why the push for more abortion? In the United States now, there's an average of one abortion performed every 30 seconds. Almost 3,000 abortions every day. Almost 1 million abortions every year. About 1/5, 20% of pregnancies end in abortion. 1 in every 5. In New York, it's 1 in every 3. And yet the left says we need more. Everything is moving in the way of more abortion, looser laws, fewer restrictions. And yet they're talking like there's a dangerous assault on women's rights. That's the real danger here. They warned that if Brett Kavanaugh were confirmed to the Supreme Court, millions of people will die. That's what they said. But what about the fact that since Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood and these other abortion mills have killed more than 61 million unborn babies? Just a decade ago, when Hillary Clinton ran for president the first time in 2008, she said her policy was for abortion to be safe, legal, and rare. And by rare, I mean rare. She said she wanted to reduce the number of abortions. Well, the left has moved far, far away from that position today. It was over the bill in Virginia that Governor Ralph Northam made comments on a local radio program. He was asked to explain, well, how late in the pregnancy could a baby be aborted? And this is how the governor responded.
If a mother is in labor, I can tell you exactly what would happen. The infant would be delivered. The infant would be kept comfortable. The infant would be resuscitated if that's what the mother and the family desired. And then a discussion would ensue between the physicians and the mother.
He's talking about a child that's already been delivered. He's talking about having a discussion over whether to allow that child to live or die after it has already been delivered. And he said this would typically be in cases where the baby is deformed or isn't viable. But here they're just reasoning their way through this situation. At one time, it's abortion should be rare. It should be early on in a pregnancy. But there's no absolute determinant of what's okay and what isn't. So you move the standard a little further. And then you move it a little further. And then you move it up to the point of birth. And then, well, you know, in some cases, maybe it would be appropriate to have this discussion even after the birth. Well, look at the deformity here. This child isn't going to have a good life. Well, we need to have a discussion about this. It's all okay, you know, as long as the infant is kept comfortable. Yeah, in this case, it's best not to resuscitate. This is eugenics. This is infanticide. This is murder. And these comments that the governor made on the radio, a lot of people were horrified by what Governor Northam said. And then, you know, the story in the mainstream media, the story became about the conservative backlash and these efforts to deny women their rights. If somebody is upset about what he said, well, they're just trying to take us back to the dark ages of back alley abortions with coat hangers. That's always the story. It's not about the fact that abortion is big business. The fact that taxpayers subsidized about 24% of all abortion costs in the U.S., taxpayers. 6.6% is paid by federal taxpayers, 17.4% picked up by state taxpayers. Planned Parenthood takes in $1.4 billion a year. The abortion industry brings in over $2 billion a year, maybe a lot more than that. That's not the story. The story isn't the fact that abortion clinics are encouraging abortion. They're not talking to women about just how serious this choice is. They're trying to get them in and out as quick as they can. It's not about those things. It's not about the reports of representatives of tissue procurement companies pressuring women who are sitting in abortion clinic waiting rooms to donate their baby's body parts for research. Now, they want to ignore the moral dimension of this question entirely. It's not about that at all in their minds. Well, this is what happens when we view human life as matter. It's just matter. It's just atoms colliding with atoms. This is what happens when we don't see anything sacred about human life. This is what happens when we push God aside, when we ignore that He alone decides right and wrong. He reserves to Himself the power over life and death. This is what happens when we take these decisions on ourselves. This is what happens when we discard the truth that God is our creator. When we think of this vast, spectacular creation as just a big cosmic accident, there's no meaning, no purpose, no inherent value. This is what happens when we cast aside the revelation in the Bible that God made us in His image, that He gave us tremendous potential that He didn't give to any other creation, and the truth that every single life matters. This is what happens. God says abortion is murder, and society today vehemently disagrees. We've disagreed for decades now, but lately this view has been advancing. It's been getting bolder. It's been getting more aggressive. And as it does, again, they're using the language of rights and freedom and women's equality and health. They're actually saying this is a health issue. What are they really talking about? They're talking about murder. They're trying to make it easier and easier to murder. I'm going to play a clip from a video. This is of an abortionist who's holding a tub with the contents of an abortion that he's just performed. He's washing out a tub that is full of intestines and bones and organs and tiny hands, and he's checking to make sure they got everything in the procedure. He's measuring the length of a tiny severed foot on a ruler to see how advanced the child's development was. And this is what he's saying as he's doing this.
Media attention is always directed for the fetus and the gory parts, if you will, of providing the procedure. When the really important thing is that we've been able to help this young lady get on with her life. She's planning to go on to school, and she doesn't have to take over the responsibilities of parenting. And here in just a very few minutes, we're able to facilitate her decision to not be a parent at this time.
How compassionate he is for this mother. But what about the question of right and wrong? He says, don't focus on the gory parts. Focus on the fact that you're helping her to get on with her life. And look, it only takes a few minutes. How steeped in this thinking do you have to be in order to think like that, to reason like that? This man is saying this as he's holding a tiny decapitated head in his fingers. It's all worth it if it just makes things more convenient for this young lady. That's the only criterion we should focus on. This is what they're celebrating with the passage of these abortion laws. It's not about reproductive rights. It's not about trying to protect the health of the mother. It's not about whether that's actually a child or just a clump of cells or some protoplasmic mass. It's about, well, this woman should be able to walk away from parenthood. She should be able to just walk away the same way that a man can. That's what we need That's what we need more of in society. In his book, Mystery of the Ages, Herbert W. Armstrong wrote this about abortion. The human spirit enters the human embryo at conception. At conception, it is this spirit that may, upon adult conversion, be united with the Holy Spirit from the great Creator God, impregnating that human with God life as a child of the living God, in a state of gestation, though as yet unborn. He's speaking spiritually. To destroy an embryo or a fetus in a mother's uterus is to murder a potential future God being. Therefore, abortion is murder. If you want more proof that the Bible considers abortion murder, go to thetrumpet.com and read our article, Is Abortion Really Murder? But this is what happens. This is what happens when the sanctity of human life is trivialized. The Apostle Paul prophesied in 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 4, that in the last days, perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, very selfish, very self-centered, disobedient to parents, without natural affection, without self-control, fierce or brutal, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. Well, we are living in the last days that Paul prophesied of. Our world is rife with the attitudes that he spoke of, those attitudes that lead to illicit sex, that lead to unwanted babies, that lead to parents who just want to walk away from parenthood, attitudes that lead to brutal abortions on the scale of millions upon millions. These are signs showing that we're living in the last days.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Efforts to pull away from the brink of nuclear annihilation have been going on for decades. Recently, some of the most well-known of these efforts were abandoned. It's an ominous mile marker indicating the reemergence of the threat of nuclear war, as we will now hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
The administration of United States President Donald Trump announced on February 2nd that the U.S. is suspending compliance with the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty with Russia. And Russia then said it too was abandoning the treaty, which bans both countries from developing or using moderate-range nuclear missiles. This is a major development with potential implications for every person alive. And it's a development that should cause us to take stock of our lives and to ask ourselves some difficult questions. But to begin, we need to consider how we got here with the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, or the INF Treaty. It dates back to the 1980s, which was a very tense time in the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Both sides were building ever larger, ever more capable arsenals of nuclear weapons. And one of the weapon systems that the Soviets had recently built was called the SS-20. This was a significant upgrade from the USSR's existing missile systems because it was mobile, highly accurate, and capable of being easily hidden and quickly redeployed. It also carried multiple nuclear warheads that could hit multiple targets. It could fly NAP of the Earth, which means very low-altitude flight paths that hug the Earth's contours and evade radar systems. And probably most significant was the SS-20's range. The range of its missiles was about 3,400 miles. So that was short enough to bring the SS-20 into compliance with the strategic arms limitation treaties that were then in place. But it was long enough to place almost all of Europe in these missiles' reach. So the SS-20 was an extremely dangerous weapon system, mostly because it would only take a few minutes to strike its targets, leaving no time for decision makers to weigh in. So it significantly increased the likelihood of a global nuclear war over a false launch warning. The United States knew it needed some sort of answer for the SS-20, so the American military developed the Pershing II. Like the SS-20, Martin Marietta's Pershing II was mobile, easily concealable, remarkably accurate, able to fly nap of the earth, and able to strike targets with warheads hundreds of times more powerful than the bombs dropped on Japan in just a few minutes' time. Both sides knew how high the stakes were, and when Mikhail Gorbachev became leader of the Soviet Union in 1985, he made clear that he hoped to eliminate all nuclear weapons by the year 2000. Ronald Reagan was U.S. president at the time, and he also abhorred nuclear weapons. So the two sides came together and began working on negotiations to remove some of their nuclear weapons, and especially the intermediate-range ones that increased the risk of miscalculation and made the threat of nuclear war so much higher. The talks and negotiations took years. There were many starts and stops along the way, but eventually sanity prevailed, and on December 8th of 1987, the two men signed the INF Treaty. Here is President Reagan speaking to the world on that momentous day.
This ceremony and the treaty we're signing today are both excellent examples of the rewards of patience. On the Soviet side, over 1,500 deployed warheads will be removed. And all ground-launched intermediate-range missiles, including the SS-20s, will be destroyed. On our side, our entire complement of Pershing II and ground-launched cruise missiles, with some 400 deployed warheads, will all be destroyed. Additional backup missiles on both sides will also be destroyed. But the importance of this treaty transcends numbers.
So the Soviet Union withdrew its SS-20s and destroyed them. And the U.S. withdrew and destroyed its Pershing IIs, as President Reagan said there. And both sides agreed to ban future development of such land-based systems. And it really drew both sides back from the brink in a remarkable way, thanks to the INF Treaty. But in 2008, there was no more Soviet Union and no more Mikhail Gorbachev. Instead, there was the Russian Federation and Vladimir Putin. Putin does not agree with Gorbachev's decision to sign the INF any more than he agreed with the decision of his other predecessor, Nikita Khrushchev, to give the Crimean Peninsula to Ukraine. So as with the Crimean decision, Vladimir Putin reversed what his predecessor had done with the INF. The INF treaty was still intact in 2008, but Putin's military began developing a weapon system called the SSC-8, which is a land-based cruise missile with a range believed to be up to 1,500 miles. So this system was a blatant violation of the INF treaty. In 2014, after about 6 years of quiet development, the Russians tested the SSC-8 for the first time. The Obama administration and the U.S. decried the test and urged Putin to adhere to the INF treaty. But rather than heed these calls from the Obama administration, Putin and the Russians denied that they were violating the INF treaty. In clear and obvious contradiction of the facts, they claimed that the SSC-8 wasn't violating it, and they forged ahead with the nuclear missile system. In February of 2017, the SSC-8 was fully operational, and at least two battalions of it were deployed. At that time, Jeffrey Lewis of the Middlebury Institute's James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies summed up the development. He said the SSC-8's deployment shows that old Soviet patterns are reemerging. In the years since then, the U.S. and nations in Europe and other world powers called Russia out on this flagrant violation several times. And then on February 2nd, the official suspension was announced. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made this announcement at the State Department.
For years, Russia has violated the terms of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty without remorse. To this day, Russia remains in material breach of its treaty obligations not to produce, possess, or flight test a ground-launched intermediate-range cruise missile system with a range between 500 and 5,500 kilometers. In spite of this violation, for almost 6 years, the United States has gone to tremendous lengths to preserve this agreement and ensure security for our people, our allies, and our partners. We have raised Russia's noncompliance with Russian officials, including at the highest levels of government, more than 30 times. Yet Russia continues to deny that its missile system is noncompliant and violates the treaty.
From there, Pompeo explains that Russia's violations put the lives of millions of Europeans and Americans at greater risk. And he explains how it puts the U.S. at a military disadvantage. He then reminds the audience that back in December of 2018, the U.S. made one last attempt to convince the Russians to abide by the agreement. And he told Russia that if they did not do so within 60 days, then America would suspend its obligation of the treaty. And then he continues.
Russia has refused to take any steps to return real and verifiable compliance over these 60 days. The United States will therefore suspend its obligations under the INF Treaty effective February 2nd. Russia has jeopardized the United States' security interest, and we can no longer be restricted by the treaty while Russia shamelessly violates it.
So the Trump administration said the U.S. can't be the only country unilaterally bound by this treaty, and it suspended its compliance. America has said that at this point it's only a suspension, but that in 6 months, if the Russians don't end their treaty violations, then the withdrawal will be official. The Russians, as we would expect, are playing the victim here. They are accusing America of destabilizing the world by leaving the INF treaty, but that's a complete misrepresentation of the facts. And now the risk of nuclear war breaking out is increasing once again. And in all of mankind's solutions and proposals, there's no option for securing sure and lasting peace. There's nothing to guarantee that these unfathomably destructive weapons will not be used on people. And there's really no hope. But there is hope in the Bible. The Bible contains the solution to this seemingly unsolvable problem. But it also contains some very sobering warnings. And Scripture actually describes nuclear warfare and some of its aftermath in detail. Amos 5 and verse 3 show that in some cities, only 10% of the population will survive. Jeremiah 2 verse 15 shows that in other cities, they will be entirely burned up without a single inhabitant left. And the Bible is clear that nuclear war will break out in the near future. Matthew 24 verses 21 through 22 in the New Living Translation record Jesus Christ as saying, "There will be greater anguish than at any time since the world began, and it will never be so great again. In fact, unless that time of calamity is shortened, not a single person will survive." End quote. So this could only be describing a global nuclear war with enough detonations to cause nuclear winter. And it will threaten to end every human life on the planet. This is a chilling prophecy, and the suspension of the INF Treaty brings it palpably closer to fulfillment. But as we see that utterly devastating time of war approach, there is cause for hope. Continuing the passage in Matthew 24, just after Christ says that nuclear war at the end of this age will be so devastating that it could end all human life, he then adds a very crucial detail. He says, quote, "But it will be shortened." Nuclear World War III will be interrupted. Before man detonates enough weapons to entirely obliterate himself, Jesus Christ will cut the war short. Following just after that season of unprecedented death, he will usher in an age of unprecedented peace. Amos 9 shows that the cities that had been left with only 10% of the population will be rebuilt. Jeremiah shows that as the people rebuild, each of them will come to know God. And regarding this future time of worldwide tranquility and prosperity, Isaiah says, "Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." War, nuclear and otherwise, will then be a relic of a bygone era. In his booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry thoroughly examines these scriptures, and he explains both the danger and the hope that they point to. And he writes, quote, "We are now at the edge of nuclear abyss. But as all these horrible signs come to pass, we know Christ is about to return."
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. That is very good reporting. We appreciate that. You know, I just thinking about the overall issue, it's amazing how little press this type of story gets. It seems like it's an issue that most people are very content to overlook and to ignore. Do you have any thoughts as to why that would be? And you're in the news, you're looking at these things, and you're recognizing the ramifications of some of these developments. Why so little interest broadly?
Well, I think you're right that there is a surprising dearth of press coverage, and what there is really seems aimed at maligning President Trump. You know, they pin it on him and say, "How dare Trump withdraw from this landmark treaty? He's bringing the world to the brink." Serious analysts know that this was the only course of action that Russia left for the U.S. because they were flagrantly violating it. And, you know, from a foreign policy standpoint, it just didn't make sense for the U.S. to be unilaterally bound to this treaty as the only country. So it's shameful that what little press there is often takes that angle. But I think also that dearth of coverage is just symptomatic of human nature's desire to hear smooth things. You know, the Bible talks about people, even in times of approaching calamity and chaos, kind of looking down on those who warned them about it. It's a pattern we see over and over again in Scripture. We even saw it in the lead up to World War II when Winston Churchill was just lambasted over and over again. You know, "Please stop telling us that there's going to be another war soon." So I think it's just we would rather keep our heads in the sand, as the idiom says, and just sort of ignore naysayers and the Cassandras and soothsayers and all that, and just focus on what sounds nice and fun, and eat and drink and be merry, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So you mentioned that Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door booklet by Gerald Flurry. Maybe you could just give us an idea of what's in that booklet, and then any other literature that might be of value to someone looking into this subject.
Sure. Yes. This booklet, Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door, really takes a dive into these scriptures about the lead up to Christ's return, with particular emphasis on Matthew 24 verses 21 and 22. Mm-hmm. Most of the book centers around Matthew 24. Mm-hmm. So it talks about several of the other signs leading up to the return of Christ, but it focuses mostly on that one. It was published at the time when North Korea was rattling their sabers a lot more. So there's quite a lot of attention drawn to just what a lunatic nation that is, and that they now have deployable, you know, nuclear warheads. So, and that threat has certainly not diminished any since the time the book was written, even though North Korea is not in the headlines as much as it once was. But anyway, it's a very powerful booklet that shows, you know, both the incredible danger and the even more incredible hope that's in all these passages. Mm-hmm. And then there's also an article of yours, actually, called Four Signs the Second Coming is Near, which shows how nuclear weapons really help us identify where we are in end-time prophecy. So I think that's a very powerful one also that listeners could learn quite a lot from.
All right. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the end of a nuclear nonproliferation treaty and the possibility of a coming nuclear war as prophesied in Bible prophecy. He's working on an article on the subject for thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that online. Thanks very much, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Europe is grappling with a serious migrant crisis and has sought common solutions. One of these has been to try to address the causes of the crisis back in the Middle East, from where the migrants are originating. Debates among EU leaders have led to little progress, but a few European leaders are taking it upon themselves to get more personally involved in the region. And this whole situation points to the fulfillment of some pillar end-time Bible prophecies. To talk about this, we have trumpet writer Josue Michels. Hello, Josue.
Hello, Mr. Erika.
It's good to have you here. So the EU has tried to solve the refugee crisis at its source in the Middle East. They've taken steps like fighting the Islamic State, sending development aid. But there are some European leaders who think these steps are not enough. Tell us about that.
Yes, there's quite a few leaders that start to see the crisis in the Middle East from a whole different perspective. They recognize what the EU has done. They see the humanitarian projects. They see the fight against the Islamic State as a really good thing. But they believe that a whole other dimension is missing from the solution to that crisis. Most of all, they are concerned that the EU overlooks the persecuted Christians in the region. Thousands of Christians are persecuted in the Middle East and are running for their life. Churches are destroyed and communities are demolished. But the European Union has not focused on specifically helping those communities. And two leaders in specific have started to address this issue. Viktor Orban, he has demanded from the EU for years to get more involved in the Middle East and to specifically help those persecuted Christians.
Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary.
That's right, yes. He is seen as a far-right leader and really rejected by the rest of the European Union because of that. But he believes that he has the solution to the crisis in the Middle East. And he's not the only one who takes that approach. The Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, he has taken the exact same approach. He has taken on a cooperation with the Catholic Church, actually. The Archbishop of Vienna, Christoph Schönborn, has held a few meetings with Chancellor Kurz, and they have agreed that they too have to do the same as Viktor Orban does and help the specifically persecuted Christians in the Middle East themselves.
So Orban and Kurz, and it is interesting, I guess Orban maybe is considered a little bit more to the right, but Kurz is very widely respected and fairly mainstream politician in Austria, but they're definitely aligned on this matter.
Yes, that's right. And one of the things that Sebastian Kurz seeks to do is to mediate between the East and West, and in that way, he tries to cooperate as much as he can with the current European Union. But at the same time, he really believes a lot of the things that Orban does are the right course of action.
Mm-hmm. So to this point, these leaders are in the minority among European leaders. What do the other European leaders think of, say, their specific efforts to take up the cause of these persecuted Christians? And why haven't more people taken a similar approach?
Viktor Orban, he once made an interesting statement. He said anytime he speaks in the European Parliament about Europe's Christian heritage, he is viewed upon as a man, as a leader from the Middle Ages, from the Dark Ages, from the times of the Holy Roman Empire. And they believe that's of the past. And Europe today is a secularized European Union based no more on Christian values, but much more on a new vision of a modern Europe. So it has become really less and less religious, and there has been a division between church and state, obviously. And since that time, they have not focused on specifically addressing those issues that the church would be interested in.
So we definitely, we've talked about this quite a bit on this program, see competing trends within Europe. There is definitely, say, that that mainstream trend that has really defined Europe for quite a few decades that has been more secular. But there is definitely a countervailing trend, the rise of this other group. And you can look at Orban and Kurz as being sort of the leaders that represent this movement that are saying this isn't working. The secularization hasn't been working. And in some ways, it seems like the plight of the Christians in the Middle East shows what happens if they take a more passive approach and they just they fail to stand up for those values that have defined Europe, not for maybe the last couple of decades, but for centuries. And you have these leaders who are standing up and saying, yes, we actually need to revitalize that more ancient history, that more ancient heritage, if we're going to be able to survive.
That's right. And many in the European Union, they basically reject the history because they believe that people of the past, that they were somewhat like subhumans, and that today modern Europeans and even Muslims think much differently, and they would never start a crusade again, or that a clash of civilization would never happen again. And that's why they thought it would be no problem to leave the Christians in the Middle East as it is. But now we see that Islam is actually pushing those Christians out. And now we see that other Europeans want to defend those Christian values in the Middle East. And if they don't defend them, Islam will eventually take over the Middle East. And that's why some of the European leaders now step it up.
So give us some examples of what Orban and Kurz are doing in the Middle East in order to help out.
Now, that's very interesting because there are many, many humanitarian organizations, but Sebastian Kurz and Viktor Orban, they don't work necessarily with those organizations. Instead, they invite the specific Christian leaders from the Middle East, from Syria, from Iraq. In Iraq, there's the Chaldean Catholic Church and the Syrian Orthodox Church is in Syria, and the Syrian Catholic Church is in Syria as well. And Sebastian Kurz, he invited the leaders from those churches over to Austria to host a meeting and to address the issue that they are facing currently in the Middle East. And he wanted to know from them specifically what can be done to strengthen the Christian communities. And also present at the meeting was the Archbishop from Vienna, Christoph Schönborn. And together, Kurz and Schönborn, they have committed themselves to specifically invest in those churches to help them rebuild the communities that have been destroyed by radical Islam, the churches that have been destroyed by radical Islam, and also schools that have been destroyed, so that the Christian communities have again a safe place to live. And Viktor Orban has done the same for many years already. In 2016, he has added to his humanitarian organization a specific brand that helps persecuted Christians in the Middle East. And he too has hosted those leaders of the Middle Eastern churches and specifically given them financial aid to help them build up the communities again.
Now, just looking at the overall picture in the Middle East and how these Christians are such a beleaguered minority in that area, the virulence of and the aggressiveness of Islamic believers in that area, just how the way that they treat anyone who doesn't adhere to their orthodox view, even Muslims who depart from the faith face terrible persecution. The idea that, say, coming in and rebuilding a church and, you know, taking some of these, smaller initiatives to try to protect some of the people down there, it does seem like a bit of a optimistic that this would really make much of a difference. What is your view in terms of the overall effort that they're making? It seems like Kurz and Orban, in a way, they're among these European leaders who are recognizing that there is something like a clash of civilizations approaching, and that there's only so much that, say, these kinds of initiatives is going to accomplish. I just wonder if this is a precursor in their minds to more radical measures that might be taken down the road.
Yes, I do believe that they have that in mind. They might have an optimistic viewpoint that once they are more involved with humanitarian projects, they will convince more and more Muslims that have also been suffering under that persecution to cooperate with them more. And I believe, and the Bible prophesies of an alliance between moderate Muslims and Christians. But at the same time, they for sure know that radical Islam, like the Islamic State or Iran, they would never want to cooperate with Christians. In fact, they are destroying the Christian communities that Orban and Kurz seek to build up. They tear the churches down that Orban and Kurz are building up. So to think that you can build up churches again and again will not solve that issue for sure. And that's why Viktor Orban, he also said we need to increase our military presence in the region to make sure that we push radical Islam back. And Kurz said in his government that one of his prime focuses is also to push radical Islam back, and the only way to do that is militarily. Now, I'm not sure how far they see, but as a matter of fact, they know that radical Islam has to be pushed back militarily. Mm-hmm. And if they don't give in, they have to push it back all the way to Iran. And we have proven that before to be the source of much of the terrorism in the Middle East.
Yeah, it does seem, well, for anyone who's followed the trumpet for any length of time, that to see European leaders of the mold of the ones that you're describing, who are coming to power, who are taking this kind of a vested interest in what is happening in the Middle East, and they're directing their focus not just to trying to prevent more refugees from coming into Europe, but they're specifically trying to shore up the position of a minority of Christians within the region. It does seem very telling when you view it in light of the Bible's prophecies. And we talk quite a bit about not only the prophecies. You mentioned the one about there being an alliance between Europe and some of the more moderate Muslim states, but also the violent clash that's going to take place between a Catholic-led Europe and an Islamic-led power in the Middle East. So you definitely see the outlines of that taking place when you're talking about the specific personalities involved and what's motivating these decisions that they're taking.
Yeah, and it is quite inspiring in a way to see what is happening, because the Bible has been so specific about the upcoming prophecies, and to see it now unfold is quite exciting, because the Bible prophesied there will be alliance between moderate Muslim states and Catholic Europe, but it also prophesied that that alliance will push radical Islam back. It also said that the Catholic Church will unite with many of those daughter churches. Some of those daughter churches are in the Middle East, and they are turning now to Catholic Europe for help. And we are seeing also that some of the nations like Orban and Kurz, Hungary and Austria, they are uniting in that effort. So it matches up in many, many ways with Bible prophecy. And the only reason that the mainstream media ignores it in the moment is because they believe that Orban and Kurz are outsiders in the moment, pursuing their own goals. But from Bible prophecy we know that many more European leaders will follow exactly what they are doing right now in the Middle East.
So maybe you could just talk about the Bible's prophecies and some of the articles that someone might find useful if they want more information about this subject.
No, first of all, I would recommend the book The King of the South by Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Mr. Gerald Fluey, because it gives the big overview of the whole picture. It explains why there is a clash between radical Islam and Christian Europe in the first place. It also explains why there is an alliance between some moderate Muslim states as well as Europe. It also explains why Christian Europe wants to have more Christians in the Middle East. It explains their overall quest for Jerusalem. And if one wants to find out more how that specifically unfolds, I have written an article entitled An Unholy Alliance to Save Persecuted Christians. That one talks about Sebastian Kurz's effort, along with the Catholic Church, to really get more involved in the Middle East. And that one can be studied for that purpose.
All right, we appreciate that. We've been talking with trumpet writer Josue Michels about European leaders' incursions into the Middle East. You can read his articles. He mentioned the one, An Unholy Alliance to Save Persecuted Christians. He's also got one called Sebastian Kurz Sets His Sights on Jerusalem. Those are both on thetrumpet.com and will give you a really good sense of just how much these leaders are setting their sights on what's happening there in the Middle East and what it points to in the prophecies of the Bible. We appreciate that very much. Thank you, Josue.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
If you are a parent with children living under your roof, then you are responsible before God for their spiritual education. And that responsibility comes with the opportunity to instruct from the Bible. If you study the book of Deuteronomy, you see Moses felt a similar responsibility to build the families of Israel. This was his final instruction to God's people just before he died and they entered the promised land. He repeatedly emphasized parents' duty to pass spiritual wisdom to their children and grandchildren. Deuteronomy 6 says, "And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up." Surely Moses had witnessed a lot of failure among Israel's families, and you can sense his urgency. Commit these words to heart, then teach them diligently to your children. Discuss them at every opportunity. This is how to survive as a nation. Moses did more than command family Bible studies. He emphasized the importance of reinforcing those Bible lessons throughout the day, at home and away. He expected parents and children to be interacting often and for the Bible to be a regular topic of discussion. He stressed the need for instructing each night before bedtime and again each morning. Moses followed up with very practical instruction. He said, write out certain scriptures and principles, post them in the house, help internalize them. Spend some time taking these scriptures to heart, even committing yourself to them in prayer before God. Life can be a jungle of duties and distractions, and we might agree with Moses' statements in principle, but then struggle to implement them. We may make an effort, but lack the consistency these scriptures demand. The mention of diligence and repetition are aimed directly at countering our natural tendency to allow this duty to slip. Consider the rewards of making family Bible instruction the priority God intends. Moses himself described the rich blessings these studies and discussions would bring, including a better relationship with God, stronger families, longer, more abundant life for ourselves, for our children and grandchildren. Every parent wants a close bond with his children. Quality family Bible study and discussion is a key to achieving that. Parent to child, grandparent to child, spiritual instruction. This is glue that binds generation to generation. It's a powerful antidote to the poisonous influences of the world that aim to tear children away from their parents. And even more, obedience to this command welds individual families into a single nation under God. Moses showed that it does nothing less than ensure long-lasting national stability and guarantees a future as a godly nation. Just think about those promises that he made in conjunction with Proverbs 22 and verse 6, which says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." It's an incredible promise in these scriptures. If parents in Israel had diligently followed the command to teach their children, the nation never would have departed from God's way. And really, there are many, many problems in our nation because people are ignoring these basic commands. But we do not have to do that. Let's learn from this failure and heed the urgent plea from this great God-inspired man and make sure we're rearing our children to know and to love the Bible. The idea of expounding on the scriptures for your family, this may seem very daunting, but here are a few simple points that'll help you move from agreeing in principle with this biblical command to actually making it a part of your family's regular routine. First, you yourself have to be excited about the Bible. You've got to love His Word and be stirred and moved about your own Bible study. How much do you know about the Bible? Get accustomed to searching the Scriptures for answers to the problems you face. Think about what you read. Relate the Bible verses to real-life situations. And as you build excitement in your personal study, your eagerness to pass it on to your children is going to grow. As far as what to study, there are a lot of high-quality youth Bible-based books to read to your children. You can go to www.pcog.org to the youth section. I do that with my kids quite a lot and read articles to them from there. But you can also read straight from the Bible. You might go somewhat methodically through a portion of the Bible, like the Proverbs or the Gospels. Adapt your study at times according to your family's specific needs at that time. You might want to choose a particular theme for a week and give several related studies hitting that topic from various angles. Try to make God real to your children. Talk about God's qualities of character. Get into the details of His miracles. Read to them about His mighty acts. Now, each specific study may only involve one verse or maybe two or three verses. You can rephrase it and in plain terms explain it, making it very practical and show how that links to real life examples. Be creative in getting the concepts across. Make it fun, make it exciting, and be sure that the children understand. Ask them questions, have them think of examples of their own, and encourage them to link the principles that you're reading about to their own daily lives. The more practical and understandable the teaching is, the easier it will be to reinforce it in discussion. And don't go on for too long. Depending on your children's age and attention span, you might go for 5 minutes, maybe up to 20 minutes or so. But work to hold their interest and keep it a positive experience. Praise them as they progress. Ensure that the overall feeling is that studying the Bible is enjoyable and that God's way is great. Moses' command is really a positive command, that we share our spiritual riches with our children. Deuteronomy 6 and other related scriptures really embody a way of life, a way that pulsates with life and with robust interactions between generations. Family Bible studies require diligent effort, but the blessings they produce are well worth it. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Jeremiah Jacques and Josue Michels. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Maurice Setter. Too many people miss the silver lining because they're expecting gold. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.